'Tis a memoir by Frank McCourt. Prologue. That's your dream out now. That's what my mother would say when we were children in Ireland and a dream we had came true. The one I had over and over was where I sailed into New York Harbor, awed by the skyscrapers before me. I'd tell my brothers, and they'd envy me for having spent a night in America, till they began to claim they'd had that dream too. They knew it was a sure way to get attention. Even though I'd argue with them, tell them I was the oldest, that it was my dream, and they'd better stay out of it or there'd be trouble. They told me I had no right to that dream for myself, that anyone could dream about America in the far reaches of the night, and there was nothing I could do about it. I told them I could stop them. I'd keep them awake all night, and they'd have no dreams at all. Michael was only 6. And here he was, laughing at the picture of me going from one of them to the other, trying to stop their dreams of the New York skyscrapers. Maliki said I could do nothing about his dreams because he was born in Brooklyn and could dream about America all night and well into the day if he liked. I appealed to my mother. I told her it wasn't fair the way the whole family was invading my dreams, and she said, Ada, for the love of God, drink your tea and go to school and stop tormenting us with your dreams. My brother Alfie was only 2 and learning words, and he banged a spoon on the table and chanted, tormenting dreams, till everyone laughed. And I knew I could share my dreams with him any time. So, why not with Michael? Why not Maliki? Chapter 1. When the MS Irish Oak sailed from Cork in October 1949, we expected to be in New York City in a week. Instead, after 2 days at sea, we were told we were going to Montreal in Canada. I told the first officer all I had was $40, and would Irish Shipping pay my train fare from Montreal to New York? He said, no, the company wasn't responsible. He said, freighters are the whores of the high seas. They'll do anything for anyone. You could say a freighter is like Murphy's old dog. He'll go part of the road with any wanderer. 2 days later, Irish Shipping changed his mind and gave us the happy news. Sail for New York City. But 2 days after that, the captain was told, sail for Albany. The first officer told me Albany was a city far up the Hudson River, capital of New York State. He said Albany had all the charm of Limerick. Ha ha ha. A great place to die, but not a place where you'd want to get married or rear children. He was from Dublin and knew I was from Limerick. And when he sneered at Limerick, I didn't know what to do. I'd like to destroy him with a smart remark, but then I'd look at myself in the mirror, pimply face, sore eyes, bad teeth, and no, I could never stand up to anyone, especially a first officer with a uniform and a promising future as master of his own ship. Then I'd said to myself, why should I care what anyone says about Limerick anyway? All I had there was misery. Then the peculiar thing would happen. I'd sit in a deck chair in the lovely October sun with the gorgeous blue Atlantic all around me and try to imagine what New York would be like. I tried to see Fifth Avenue or Central Park or Greenwich Village, where everyone looked like movie stars, powerful tans, gleaming white teeth. But Limerick would push me into the past. Instead of me sauntering up Fifth Avenue with the tan and the teeth, I'd be back in the lanes of Limerick, women standing at doors, chatting away, pulling their shawls around their shoulders, children with faces dirty from bread and jam, playing and laughing and crying to their mothers. I'd see people at Mass on Sunday mornings where a whisper would run through the church when someone with a hunger weakness would collapse in the pew and have to be carried outside by men from the back of the church who'd tell everyone, stand back, for the love of Jesus. Can't you see she's gasping for the air? And I wanted to be a man like that, telling people stand back, because that gave you the right to stay outside till the mass was over. And you could go off to the pub, which is why you were standing in the back with all the other men in the first place. Men who didn't drink always knelt right up there by the altar to show how good they were, and how they didn't care if the pub stayed closed till doomsday. They knew the responses to the mass better than anyone, and they'd be blessing themselves and standing and kneeling and sighing over their prayers, as if they felt the pain of Our Lord more than the rest of the congregation. Some had given up the pint entirely, and they were the worst, always preaching the evil of the pint, and looking down on the ones still in the grip, as if they were on the right track to heaven. They acted as if God himself would turn his back on a man drinking the pint, when everyone knew you'd rarely hear a priest up in the pulpit denounce the pint, or the men who drank it. Men with a thirst stayed in the back, ready to streak out the door the minute the priest said, "Ita missa est," "Go, you are dismissed." They stayed in the back because their mouths were dry and they felt too humble to be up there with the sober ones. I stayed near the door so that I could hear the men whispering about the slow mass. They went to mass because it's a mortal sin if you don't, though you'd wonder if it wasn't the worst sin to be joking to the man next to you, that if this priest didn't hurry up, you'd expire of the thirst on the spot. If Father White came out to give the sermon, they'd shuffle and groan over his sermons, the slowest in the world, with him rolling his eyes to heaven and declaring we were all doomed unless we mended our ways and devoted ourselves to the Virgin Mary entirely. My Uncle Pat Keating would have the men laughing behind their hands with his, "I'd devote myself to the Virgin Mary if she handed me a lovely creamy black pint of porter." I wanted to be there with my Uncle Pat Keating, all grown up with long trousers, and stand with the men in the back with the great thirst and laugh behind my hand. I'd sit on that deck chair and look into my head to see myself cycling around Limerick City and out into the country delivering telegrams. I'd see myself early in the morning riding along country roads with the mist rising in the fields and cows giving me the odd moo, dogs coming at me till I drove them away with rocks. I'd hear babies in farmhouses crying for their mothers and farmers whacking cows back to the fields after the milking. And I'd start crying to myself on that deck chair with the gorgeous Atlantic all around me, New York ahead, city of my dreams, where I'd have the golden tan, the dazzling white teeth. I'd wonder what in God's name was wrong with me, that I should be missing Limerick already, city of grey miseries, the place where I dreamed of escape to New York. I'd hear my mother's warning, "The devil you know is better than the devil you don't know." There were to be 14 passengers on the ship, but one cancelled, and we had to sail with an unlucky number. The first night out, the captain stood up at dinner and welcomed us. He laughed and said he wasn't superstitious over the number of passengers, but since there was a priest among us, wouldn't it be lovely if his reverence would say a prayer to come between us and all harm? The priest was a plump little man, born in Ireland, but so long in his Los Angeles parish, he had no trace of an Irish accent. When he got up to say a prayer and bless himself, four passengers kept their hands in their laps, and that told me they were Protestants. My mother used to say you could spot Protestants a mile away by their reserved manner. The priest asked Our Lord to look down on us with pity and love, that whatever happened on these stormy seas, we were ready to be enfolded forever in his divine bosom. An old Protestant reached for his wife's hand. She smiled and shook her head back at him. He smiled too, as if to say, "Don't worry." The priest sat next to me at the dinner table. He whispered that those two old Protestants were very rich from raising thoroughbred racehorses in Kentucky, and if I had any sense, I'd be nice to them. You never know. I wanted to ask what was the proper way to be nice to rich Protestants who raise racehorses, but I couldn't for fear the priest might think I was a fool. I heard the Protestants say the Irish people were so charming and their children so adorable, you hardly noticed how poor they were. I knew that if I ever talked to the rich Protestants, I'd have to smile and show my destroyed teeth, and that would be the end of it. The minute I made some money in America, I'd have to rush to a dentist to have my smile mended. You could see from the magazines and the films how the smile opened doors and brought girls running. And if I didn't have the smile, I might as well go back to Limerick and get a job sorting letters in a dark back room at the post office, where they wouldn't care if you hadn't a tooth in your head. Before bedtime, the steward served tea and biscuits in the lounge. The priest said, "I'll have a double scotch, forget the tea, Michael. The whiskey helps me sleep." He drank his whiskey and whispered to me again, "Did you talk to the rich people from Kentucky?" I didn't. "Damn it, what's the matter with you? Don't you want to get ahead in the world?" "I do." "Well, why don't you talk to the rich people from Kentucky? They might take a fancy to you and give you a job as a stable boy or something, and you could rise in the ranks instead of going to New York City, which is one big occasion of sin, a sink of depravity, where a Catholic has to fight day and night to keep the faith. So, why can't you talk to the nice people from Kentucky and make something of yourself?" Whenever he brought up the rich people from Kentucky, he whispered, and I didn't know what to say. If my brother Malachi were here, he'd march right up to the rich people and charm them, and they'd probably adopt him and leave him their millions along with stables, racehorses, a big house, and maids to clean it. I never talked to rich people in my life except to say, "Telegram, ma'am." And then I'd be told to go around to the servants' entrance. "This is the front door. And don't you know any better?" That is what I wanted to tell the priest, but I didn't know how to talk to him either. All I knew about priests was that they said Mass and everything else in Latin, that they heard my sins in English and forgave me in Latin on behalf of our Lord himself, who's God anyway. It must be a strange thing to be a priest and wake up in the morning lying there in the bed knowing you have the power to forgive people or not forgive them depending on your mood. When you know Latin and forgive sins, it makes you powerful and hard to talk to because you know the dark secrets of the world. Talking to a priest is like talking to God himself, and if you say the wrong thing, you're doomed. There wasn't a soul on that ship who could tell me how to talk to rich Protestants and demanding priests. My uncle by marriage, Pat Keating, could have told me, but he was back in Limerick where he didn't give a fiddler's fart about anything. I knew if he were here, he'd refuse to talk to the rich people entirely, and then he'd tell the priest to kiss his royal Irish arse. That's how I'd like to be myself, but when your teeth and eyes are destroyed, you never know what to say or what to do with yourself. There was a book in the ship's library, Crime and Punishment, and I thought it might be a good murder mystery, even if it was filled with confusing Russian names. I tried to read it in a deck chair, but the story made me feel strange. A story about a Russian student, Raskolnikov, who kills an old woman, a moneylender, and then tries to convince himself he's entitled to the money because she's useless to the world and her money would pay for his university expenses, so that he could become a lawyer and go around defending people like himself who kill old women for their money. It made me feel strange because of the time in Limerick when I had a job writing threatening letters for an old woman moneylender, Mrs. Finucane, and when she died in a chair, I took some of her money to help me pay my fare to America. I knew I didn't kill Mrs. Finucane, but I took her money, and that made me almost as bad as Raskolnikov, and if I died this minute, he'd be the first one I'd run into in hell. I could save my soul by confessing to the priest, and even though he's supposed to forget your sins the minute he gives you absolution, he'd have power over me, and he'd give me strange looks and tell me, "Go charm the rich Protestants from Kentucky." I fell asleep reading the book, and a sailor, a deckhand, woke me to tell me, "Your book is getting wet in the rain, sir." "Sir?" Here I was from a lane in Limerick, and there's a man with grey hair calling me sir, even though he's not supposed to say a word to me in the first place because of the rules. The first officer told me an ordinary sailor was never allowed to speak to passengers except for a good day or good night. He told me this particular sailor with the grey hair was once an officer on the Queen Elizabeth, but he was fired because he was caught with a first-class passenger in her cabin. What they were doing was a cause of confession. This man's name was Owen, and he was peculiar the way he spent all his time reading below. And when the ship docked, he'd go ashore with a book and read in a cafe, while the rest of the crew got roaring drunk and had to be hauled back to the ship in taxis. Our own captain had such respect for him, he'd have him up to his cabin, and they'd have tea, and talk of the days they served together on an English destroyer that was torpedoed. The two of them, hanging onto a raft in the Atlantic, drifting and freezing, and chatting about the time they'd get back to Ireland and have a nice pint and a mountain of bacon and cabbage. Owen spoke to me the next day. He said he knew he was breaking the rules, but he couldn't help talking to anyone in this ship who was reading Crime and Punishment. There were great readers in the crew, right enough, but they wouldn't move beyond Edgar Wallace or Zane Grey, and he'd give anything to be able to chat about Dostoevsky. He wanted to know if I'd read The Possessed or The Brothers Karamazov, and he looked sad when I said I'd never heard of them. He told me the minute I got to New York, I should rush to a bookshop and get Dostoevsky books, and I'd never be lonely again. He said no matter what Dostoevsky book you read, he always gave you something to chew on, and you can't beat that for a bargain. That's what Owen said, though I had no notion of what he was talking about. Then the priest came along the deck, and Owen moved away. The priest said, "Were you talking to that man?" "I could see you were. Well, I'm telling you, he's not good company. You can see that, can't you? I heard all about him. Him with his gray hair swabbing decks at his age. It's a strange thing you can talk to deckhands with no morals, but if I ask you to talk to the rich Protestants from Kentucky, you can't find them in it." "We were only talking about Dostoevsky." "Dostoevsky, indeed. Not a good that'll do you in New York. You won't see many help-wanted signs requiring a knowledge of Dostoevsky. Can't get you to talk to the rich people from Kentucky, but you sit here for hours yakking with sailors. Stay away from old sailors. You know what they are. Talk to people who'll do you some good. Read The Lives of the Saints." Along the New Jersey side of the Hudson River, there were hundreds of ships docked tightly together. Owen the sailor said they were the Liberty ships that brought supplies to Europe during the war and after, and it's sad to think they'll be hauled away any day to be broken up in shipyards. But that's the way the world is, he said, and a ship lasts no longer than a whore's moan. Chapter 2. The priest asks if I have anyone meeting me. When I tell him there's no one, he says I can travel with him on the train to New York City. He'll keep an eye on me. When the ship docks, we take a taxi to the big Union Station in Albany. And while we wait for the train, we have coffee in great thick cups and pie on thick plates. It's the first time I ever had lemon meringue pie. And I'm thinking, if this is the way they eat all the time in America, I won't be a bit hungry, and I'll be fine and fat, as they say in Limerick. I'll have Dostoevsky for the loneliness and pie for the hunger. The train isn't like the one in Ireland where you share a carriage with five other people. This train has long cars where there are dozens of people and is so crowded some have to stand. The minute we get on, people give up their seats to the priest. He says thank you and points to the seat beside him. And I feel the people who offered up their seats are not happy to see me take one, because it's easy to see I'm nobody. Farther up the car, people are singing and laughing and calling for the church key. The priest says they're college kids going home for the weekend, and the church key is the can opener for the beer. He says they're probably nice kids, but they shouldn't drink so much, and he hopes I won't turn out like that when I live in New York. He says I should put myself under the protection of the Virgin Mary, ask her to intercede with her son to keep me pure and sober and out of harm's way. He'll pray for me all the way out there in Los Angeles, and he'll say a special mass for me on the 8th of December, the feast of the Immaculate Conception. I want to ask him why he chose that feast day, but I keep silent because he might start bothering me again about the rich Protestants from Kentucky. He's telling me this, but I'm dreaming of what it would be like to be a student somewhere in America, in a college like the ones in the films where there's always a white church spire with no cross to show it's Protestant, and there are boys and girls strolling the campus carrying great books and smiling at each other with teeth like snowdrops. When we arrive at Grand Central Station, I don't know where to go. My mother said I could try to see an old friend, Dan McAdory. The priest shows me how to use the telephone, but there's no answer from Dan. "Well," says the priest, "I can't leave you on your own in Grand Central Station." He tells the taxi driver we're going to the Hotel New Yorker. We take our bags to a room where there's one bed. The priest says, leave the bags. We got something to eat in the coffee shop downstairs. Do you like hamburgers? I don't know. I never had one in my life. He rolls his eyes and tells the waitress, bring me a hamburger with French fries and make sure the burger is well done because I'm Irish and we overcook everything. What the Irish do to vegetables is a crying shame. He says, if you can guess what the vegetable is in an Irish restaurant, you get the door prize. The waitress laughs and says she understands. She's half Irish on her mother's side, and her mother is the worst cook in the world. Her husband was Italian, and he really knew how to cook, but she lost him in the war. War, that's what she says. She really means war, but she's like all Americans who don't like to say R at the end of a word. They say car instead of car, and you wonder why they can't pronounce words the way God made them. I like the lemon meringue pie, but I don't like the way Americans leave out the R at the end of a word. While we're eating our hamburgers, the priest says I'll have to stay the night with him, and tomorrow we'll see. It's strange taking off my clothes in front of a priest, and I wonder if I should get down on my two knees and pretend to say my prayers. He tells me I can take a shower if I like, and it's the first time in my life I ever had a shower with plenty of hot water and no shortage of soap. Bar for your body and a bottle for your head. When I'm finished, I dry myself with a thick towel draped on the bathtub, and I put on my underwear before going back into the room. The priest is sitting on the bed with a towel wrapped around his fat belly, talking to someone on the phone. He puts down the phone and stares at me. My God, where did you get those drawers? In Rocha Stores, in Limerick. If you hung those drawers out the window of this hotel, people would surrender. Piece of advice, don't ever let Americans see you in those drawers. They'll think you just got off Ellis Island. Get briefs. You know what briefs are? I don't. Get them anyway. Kid like you should be wearing briefs. You're in the USA now. Okay, hop in the bed. And that puzzles me because there's no sign of a prayer. That's the first thing you'd expect of a priest. He goes off to the bathroom, but he's no sooner in there than he sticks out his head and asks me if I dried myself. I did. Well, your towel isn't touched, so what did you dry yourself with? The towel that's on the side of the bathtub. What? That's not a towel. That's the bath mat. That's what you stand on when you get out of the shower. I can see myself in a mirror over the desk, and I'm turning red and wondering if I should tell the priest I'm sorry for what I did. Or if I should stay quiet. It's hard to know what to do when you make a mistake your first night in America, but I'm sure in no time I'll be a regular Yank doing everything right. I'll order my own hamburger, learn to call chips French fries, joke with waitresses, and never again dry myself with a bath mat. Someday I'll say war and car with no R at the end, but not if I ever go back to Limerick. If I ever went back to Limerick with an American accent, they'd say I was putting on airs and tell me I had a fat arse like all the Yanks. The priest comes out of the bathroom, wrapped in a towel, patting his face with his hands, and there's a lovely smell of perfume in the air. He says, there's nothing as refreshing as aftershave lotion, and I can put on some if I like. It's right there in the bathroom. I don't know what to say or do. Should I say no thanks, or should I get out of the bed and go all the way to the bathroom and slather myself with aftershave lotion? I never heard of anyone in Limerick putting stuff on their faces after they shaved, but I suppose it's different in America. I'm sorry I didn't look for a book that tells you what to do on your first night in New York in a hotel with a priest, where you're liable to make a fool of yourself right and left. He says, well, and I tell him, ah, no thanks. He says, suit yourself, and I can tell he's a bit impatient the way he was when I didn't talk to the rich Protestants from Kentucky. He could easily tell me leave, and there I'd be, out on the street with my brown suitcase and nowhere to go in New York. I don't want to chance that, so I tell him I'd like to put on the aftershave lotion after all. He shakes his head and tells me go ahead. I can see myself in the bathroom mirror putting on the aftershave lotion, and I'm shaking my head at myself, feeling, if this is the way it's going to be in America, I'm sorry I ever left Ireland. It's hard enough coming here in the first place without priests criticizing you of your failure to hit it off with rich Kentucky Protestants, your ignorance of bath mats, the state of your underwear, and your doubts about aftershave lotion. The priest is in the bed, and when I come out of the bathroom, he tells me, okay, into the bed, we've got a long day tomorrow. He lifts the bed close to let me in, and it's a shock to see he's wearing nothing. He says, good night, and turns off the light and starts snoring without even saying a Hail Mary or a prayer before sleep. I always thought priests spent hours on their knees before sleeping, but this man must be in a great state of grace and not a bit afraid of dying. I wonder if all priests are like that, naked in the bed. It's hard to fall asleep in a bed with a naked priest snoring beside you. Then I wonder if the Pope himself goes to bed in that condition, or if he has a nun bring in pajamas with the papal colours and the papal coat of arms. I wonder how he gets out of that long white robe he wears, if he pulls it over his head or lets it drop to the floor and steps out of it. An old Pope would never be able to pull it over his head, and he'd probably have to call a passing cardinal to give him a hand, unless the cardinal himself was too old, and he might have to call a nun. Unless the Pope was wearing nothing under the white robe, which the cardinal would know about anyway, because there isn't a cardinal in the world that doesn't know what the Pope wears, since they all want to be Pope themselves and can't wait for this one to die. If a nun is called in, she has to take the white robe to be washed down in the steaming depths of the Vatican laundry room by other nuns and novices who sing hymns and praise the Lord for the privilege of washing all the clothes of the Pope and the College of Cardinals, except for the underwear, which is washed in another room by all nuns who are blind and not liable to think sinful thoughts because of what they have in their hands. And what I have in my own hand is what I shouldn't have in the presence of a priest in the bed. And for once in my life, I resist the sin and turn on my side and go to sleep. Next day, the priest finds a furnished room in the paper for $6 a week, and he wants to know if I can afford it till I get a job. We go to East 68th Street, and the landlady, Mrs. Austin, takes me upstairs to see the room. It's the end of a hallway blocked off with a partition and a door, with a window looking out on the street. There's barely space for the bed and a small chest of drawers with a mirror and a table, and if I stretch my arms, I can touch the walls on both sides. Mrs. Austin said this is a very nice room, and I'm lucky it wasn't snapped up. She's Swedish, and she can tell I'm Irish. She hopes I don't drink, and if I do, I'm not to bring girls into this room under any circumstances, drunk or sober. No girls, no food, no drink. Cockroaches smell food a mile away, and once they're in, you have them forever. She says, of course you never saw a cockroach in Ireland. There's no food there. All you people do is drink. Cockroaches will starve to death or turn into drunks. Don't tell me, I know. My sister is married to an Irishman. Worst thing she ever did. Irishmen great to go out with, but don't marry them. She takes the $6 and tells me she needs another $6 for security, gives me a receipt, and tells me I can move in any time that day. And she trusts me because I came with that nice priest, even if she's not Catholic herself. That it's enough her sister married one, an Irishman, God help her, and she's suffering for it. The priest calls another taxi to take us to the Biltmore Hotel across the street from where we came out of the Grand Central Station. He says it's a famous hotel and we're going to the headquarters of the Democratic Party, and if they can't find a job for an Irish kid, no one can. A man passes us in the hallway and the priest whispers, do you know who that is?
I don't.
Of course you don't. If you don't know the difference between a towel and a bath mat, how could you know that's the great Boss Flynn from the Bronx, the most powerful man in America, next to President Truman? The great boss presses the button for the elevator, and while he's waiting, he shoves a finger up his nose, looks at what he has in his fingertip, and flicks it away on the carpet. My mother would call that digging for gold. This is the way it is in America. I'd like to tell the priest I'm sure De Valera would never pick his nose like that, and you'd never find the Bishop of Limerick going to bed in a naked state. I'd like to tell the priest what I think of the world in general, where God torments you with bad eyes and bad teeth, but I can't, for fear he might go on about the rich Protestants from Kentucky and how I missed the opportunity of a lifetime. The priest talks to a woman at a desk in the Democratic Party, and she picks up the telephone. She says to the telephone, "Got a kid here, just off the board. You got a high school diploma?" "Nah, no diploma." "Well, what do you expect? All country still a poor country." "Yeah, I'll send him up." I'm to report on Monday morning to Mr. Carey on the 22nd floor, and he put me to work right here in the Biltmore Hotel, and aren't I a lucky kid, walking into a job right off the boat. That's what she says, and the priest tells her, "This is a great country, and the Irish owe everything to the Democratic Party, Maureen, and you just clinched another vote for the party if the kid here ever votes, ha ha ha." The priest tells me go back to the hotel, and he'll come for me later to go to dinner. He says I can walk, that the streets run east and west, the avenues north and south, and I'll have no trouble. Just walk across 42nd Street to 8th Avenue and south till I come to the New Yorker Hotel. I can read a book or a paper or take a shower, if I promise to stay away from the bath mat, ha ha. He says if we're lucky, we might meet the great Jack Dempsey himself. I tell him I'd rather meet Joe Lewis if that's possible, and he snaps at me, "You better learn to stick with your own kind." At night, the waiter at Dempsey smiles at the priest. "Jack's not here, Father. He's up to the garden checking out a middleweight from New Jersey." Garden. Jersey. My first day in New York, and already people are talking like gangsters from the films I saw in Limerick. The priest says, "My young friend here is from the old country. He'd prefer to meet Joe Lewis." He laughs, and the waiter laughs and says, "Well, that's a greenhorn talking, Father. He'll lie. Give him 6 months in this country, and he'll run like hell when he sees the darkie. What would you like to order, Father? Little something before dinner?" "I'll have a double martini dry, and I mean dry straight up with a twist. And the greenhorn, he'll have a, well, what you have?" "A beer, please." "You 18, kid?" "19. "You don't look it, though it don't matter no how long as you're with the father. Right, Father?" "Right. I'll keep an eye on him. He doesn't know a soul in New York, and I'm going to settle him in before I leave." The priest drinks his double martini and orders another with his steak. He tells me I should think of becoming a priest. He could get me a job in Los Angeles, and I'd live the life of Riley with widows dying and leaving me everything, including their daughters, ha ha. This is one hell of a martini, excuse the language. He eats most of his steak and tells the waiter to bring two apple pies with ice cream, and he'll have a double Hennessy to wash it down. He eats only the ice cream, drinks half the Hennessy, and falls asleep with his chin on his chest moving up and down. The waiter loses his smile. "God damn, he's got to pay his check. Where's his goddamn wallet? Back pocket, kid. Hand it to me." "I can't rob a priest." "You're not robbing. He's paying his goddamn check, and you're going to need a taxi to take him home." Two waiters help him to a taxi, and two bellhops at the Hotel New Yorker haul him through the lobby, up the elevator, and dump him on the bed. The bellhops tell me, "A buck tip would be nice. A buck each, kid." They leave. And I wonder what I'm supposed to do with a drunken priest. I remove his shoes the way they do when someone passes out in the films, but he sits up and runs to the bathroom where he's sick a long time. When he comes out, he's pulling at his clothes, throwing them on the floor, collar, shirt, trousers, underwear. He collapses on the bed on his back, and I can see he's in a state of excitement with his hand on himself. "Come here to me," he says, and I back away. "I know, Father." And he rolls out of the bed, slobbering and stinking of drink and puke, and tries to grab my hand to put it on him, but I back away even faster, till I'm out the door to the hallway with him standing in the door, a little fat priest crying to me, "Ah, come back, son, come back. It was the drink. Mother God, I'm sorry." But the elevator is open, and I can't tell the respectable people already in it and looking at me that I changed my mind, that I'm running back to this priest who in the first place wanted me to be polite to rich Kentucky Protestants so that I could get a job cleaning stables, and now waggles his thing at me in a way that's surely a mortal sin. Not that I'm in a state of grace myself. No, I'm not. but you'd expect the priest to set a good example and not make a holy show of himself my second night in America. I have to step into the elevator and pretend I don't hear the priest slobbering and crying, naked at the door of his room. There's a man at the front door of the hotel dressed up like an admiral, and he says, "Taxi, sir?" I tell him no thanks, and he says, "Where are you from?" "Oh, Limerick. I'm from Roscommon myself, over here 4 years." I have to ask the man from Roscommon how to get to East 68th Street, and he tells me, "Walk east on 34th Street, which is wide and well lit, till I come to 3rd Avenue, and I can get the L, or if I'm anywhere lively, I can walk straight up till I come to my street." He tells me, "Good luck. Stick with your own kind and watch out for the Puerto Ricans. They all carry knives. That's a known fact. They got that hot blood. Walk in the light along the edge of the sidewalk, or they'll be leaping at you from dark doorways." Next morning, the priest calls Mrs. Austin and tells her I should come to get my suitcase. He tells me, "Come in. The door is open." He's in his black suit, sitting on the far side of the bed with his back to me, and my suitcase is just inside the door. "Take it," he says. "I'm going to a retreat house in Virginia for a few months. I don't want to look at you, and I don't want to see you ever again, because what happened was terrible. And it wouldn't have happened if you'd used your head and gone off with the rich Protestants from Kentucky. Goodbye." It's hard to know what to say to a priest in a bad mood with his back to you, who's blaming you for everything. So all I can do is go down in the elevator with my suitcase, wondering how a man like that who forgives sins can sin himself and then blame me. I know if I did something like that, getting drunk and bothering people to put their hands on me, I'd say I did it. That's all, I did it. And how can he blame me just because I refused to talk to rich Protestants from Kentucky? Maybe that's the way priests are trained. Maybe it's hard listening to people's sins day in, day out, when there's a few you'd like to commit yourself, and then when you have a drink, all the sins you've heard explode inside you, and you're like everyone else. I know I could never be a priest listening to those sins all the time. I'd be in a constant state of excitement, and the bishop would be worn out, shipping me off to the retreat house in Virginia. Chapter 3. When you're Irish and you don't know a soul in New York and you're walking along 3rd Avenue with trains rattling along in the L above, there's great comfort in discovering there's hardly a block without an Irish bar. Costello's, the Blarney Stone, the Blarney Rose, P.J. Clark's, the Breffni, the Leitrim House, the Sligo House, Shannon's, Ireland's 32, the All Ireland. I had my first pint in Limerick when I was 16, and it made me sick. And my father nearly destroyed the family and himself with the drink, but I'm lonely in New York, and I'm lured in by Bing Crosby on jukeboxes singing Galway Bay and blinking green shamrocks, the likes of which you'd never see in Ireland. There's an angry-looking man behind the end of the bar in Costello's, and he's saying to a customer, "I don't give a tinker's damn if you have 10 PhDs. I know more about Samuel Johnson than you know about your hand. And if you don't comport yourself properly, you'll be out on the sidewalk. I'll say no more." The customer says, "But out," says the angry man. "Out. You'll get no more drink in this house." The customer claps on his hat and stalks out. And the angry man turns to me. "And you," he says, "are you 18? "I am, sir. I'm 19. "How do I know?" "I have my passport, sir." "And what is an Irishman doing with an American passport?" "I was born here, sir." He allows me to have 2 15-cent beers, tells me I'd be better off spending my time in the library than in bars like the rest of our miserable race. He tells me Dr. Johnson drank 40 cups of tea a day and his mind was clear to the end. I ask him who Dr. Johnson was, and he glares at me, takes my glass away and tells me, "Leave this bar. Walk east on 42nd Street till you come to 5th. You'll see 2 great stone lions. Walk up the steps between those 2 lions, get yourself a library card, and don't be an idiot like the rest of the bog trotters getting off the boat and stupefying themselves with drink. Read your Johnson, read your Pope, and avoid the dreamy mix." I want to ask him where he stands on Dostoevsky till he points at the door. Don't come back here till you've read the Lives of the Poets. Go on, get out. It's a warm October day, and I have nothing else to do but what I'm told. And what harm is there in wandering up to Fifth Avenue where the lions are? The librarians are friendly. Of course I can have a library card, and it's so nice to see young immigrants using the library. I can borrow 4 books if I like, as long as they're back on the due date. I ask if they have a book called The Lives of the Poets by Samuel Johnson. They say, my, 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 you're reading Johnson. I want to tell them I never read Johnson before, but I don't want them to stop admiring me. They tell me, feel free to walk around. Take a look at the main reading room on the 3rd floor. They're not a bit like the librarians in Ireland who stood guard and protected the books against the likes of me. The sight of the main reading room, north and south, makes me go weak at the knees. I don't know if it's the 2 beers I had or the excitement of my second day in New York, but I'm near tears when I look at the miles of shelves and know I'll never be able to read all those books if I live till the end of the century. There are acres of shiny tables where all sorts of people sit and read as long as they like, 7 days a week, and no one bothers them unless they fall asleep and snore. There are sections with English, Irish, American books, literature, history, religion, and it makes me shiver to think I can come here any time I like and read anything as long as I like and don't snore. I stroll back to Costello's with 4 books under my arm. I want to show the angry man I have the Lives of the Poets, but he's not there. The barman says, that would be Mr. Tim Costello himself that was going on about Johnson. And as he's talking, the angry man comes out of the kitchen. He says, you back already? I have the Lives of the Poets, Mr. Costello. You may have the Lives of the Poets under your oxter, young fella, but you don't have them in your head. So go home and read. It's Thursday, and I have nothing to do till the job starts on Monday. For lack of a chair, I sit up in the bed in my furnished room and read till Mrs. Austin knocks on my door at 11 and tells me she's not a millionaire, and it's house policy that lights be turned off at 11 to keep down her electricity bill. I turn off the light and lie in the bed listening to New York, people talking and laughing, and I wonder if I'll ever be part of the city out there talking and laughing. There's another knock at the door, and this young man with red hair and an Irish accent tells me his name is Tom Clifford, and would I like a fast beer because he works in an east side building and he has to be there in an hour. No, he won't go to an Irish bar. He wants nothing to do with the Irish, so we walk to the Rhinelander on 86th Street, where Tom tells me how he was born in America but was taken to Cork, got out as fast as he could, by joining the American Army for 3 good years in Germany, when you could get laid 10 times over for a carton of cigarettes or a pound of coffee. There's a dance floor and a band in the back of the Rhinelander, and Tom asks a girl from one of the tables to dance. He tells me, come on, ask her friend to dance. But I don't know how to dance, and I don't know how to ask a girl to dance. I know nothing about girls. How could I, after growing up in Limerick? Tom asks the other girl to dance with me, and she leads me out on the floor. I don't know what to do. Tom is stepping and twirling, and I don't know whether to go backwards or forwards with this girl in my arms. She tells me I'm stepping on her shoes, and when I tell her I'm sorry, she says, oh, forget it. I don't feel like clumping around. She goes back to her table, and I follow her with my face on fire. I don't know whether to sit at her table or go back to the bar, till she says, you left your beer on the bar. I'm glad I have an excuse to leave her because I wouldn't know what to say if I sat. I'm sure she wouldn't be interested if I told her I spent hours reading Johnson's Lives of the Poets, or if I told her how excited I was at the 42nd Street Library. I might have to find a book in the library on how to talk to girls, or I might have to ask Tom, who dances and laughs and has no trouble with the talk. He comes back to the bar and says he's going to call in sick, which means he's not going to work. The girl likes him and says she let him take her home. He whispers to me he might get laid, which means he might go to bed with her. The only problem is the other girl. He calls her my girl. Go ahead, he says. Ask her if you can take her home. Let's sit at their table and you can ask her. The beer is working on me, and I'm feeling braver, and I don't feel shy about sitting at the girls' table and telling them about Tim Costello and Dr. Samuel Johnson. Tom nudges me and whispers, "For Christ's sake, stop the Samuel Johnson stuff. Ask her home." When I look at her, I see two, and I wonder which I should ask home. But if I look between the two, I see one. That's the one I ask. "Home," she says, "you kidding me?" That's a laugh. "I'm a secretary, a private secretary, and you don't even have a high school diploma. I mean, did you look in the mirror lately?" She laughs, and my face is on fire again. Tom takes a long drink of beer, and I know I'm useless with these girls, so I leave and walk down Third Avenue, taking the odd look at my reflection in shop windows and giving up hope. Chapter 4. Monday morning, my boss, Mr. Carey, tells me I'll be a houseman, a very important job, where I'll be out front in the lobby dusting, sweeping, emptying ashtrays, and it's important because a hotel is judged by its lobby. He says we have the best lobby in the country, it's the Palm Court and known the world over. Anyone who's anyone knows about the Palm Court and the Biltmore Clock. Christ sakes, it's right there in books and short stories. Scott Fitzgerald, people like that. Important people say, "Let's meet under the clock of the Biltmore." And what happens if they come in and the place is covered with dust and buried in garbage? That's my job, to keep the Biltmore famous. I'm to clean, and I'm not to talk to guests, not even look at them. If they talk to me, I'm to say, "Yes, sir," or "Ma'am," or "No, sir," or "Ma'am," and keep working. He says I'm to be invisible, and that makes him laugh. Imagine that, huh? You're the invisible man cleaning the lobby. He says this is a big job, and I'd never have it if I hadn't been sent by the Democratic Party at the request of the priest from California. Mr. Carey says the last guy in this job was fired for talking to college girls under the clock, but he was Italian, so what do you expect? He tells me, "Keep my eye on the ball. Don't forget to take a shower every day. This is America. Stay sober. Stick with your own kind of people. You can't go wrong with the Irish. Go easy with the drink. And in a year, I might rise to the rank of porter or busboy and make tips. And who knows? Rise up to be a waiter. And wouldn't that be the end of all my worries?" He says anything is possible in America. Look at me. I have 4 suits. The head waiter in the lobby is called Maitre D. He tells me I'm to sweep up only what falls to the floor and I'm not to touch anything on the tables. If money falls to the floor or jewelry or anything like that, I'm to hand it to him, the Maitre D himself, and he'll decide what to do with it. If an ashtray is full, I'm to wait for a busboy or a waiter to tell me empty it. Sometimes there are things in ashtrays that need to be taken care of. A woman might remove an earring because of the soreness. I forget she left it in the ashtray. And there are earrings worth thousands of dollars, not that I'd know anything about that just off the boat. It's the job of the maitre d' to hold on to all earrings and return them to the women with the sore ears. There are 2 waiters working in the lobby and they rush back and forth, running into each other and barking in Greek. They tell me, "You Irish, come here, clean up, empty goddamn ashtray, take garbage, come on, come on, let's go, you drunk or something?" They yell at me in front of the college students who swarm in on Thursdays and Fridays. I wouldn't mind Greeks yelling at me if they didn't do it in front of the college girls who are golden. They toss their hair and smile with teeth you see only in America. White, perfect, and everyone has tanned movie star legs. The boys sport crew cuts, the teeth, football shoulders, and they're easy with the girls. They talk and laugh. And the girls lift their glasses and smile at the boys with shining eyes. They might be my age, but I move among them, ashamed of my uniform and my dustpan and broom. I wish I could be invisible, but I can't when the waiters yell at me in Greek and English, and something in between, or a busboy might accuse me of interfering with an ashtray that had something in it. There are times when I don't know what to do or say. A college boy with a crew cut says, Do you mind not cleaning around here just now? I'm talking to the lady. If the girl looks at me and then looks away, I feel my face getting hot. I don't know why. Sometimes a college girl would smile at me and say hi, and I don't know what to say. I'm told by the hotel people above me I'm not to say a word to the guest, though. I wouldn't know how to say hi anyway, because we never said it in Limerick, and if I said it, I might be fired from my new job and be out on the street with no priest to get me another one. I'd like to say hi and be part of that lovely world for a minute, except that a crew-cut boy might think I was gawking at his girl and report me to the maitre d'. I could go home tonight and sit up in the bed and practice smiling and saying hi. If I kept at it, I'd surely be able to handle the hi. But I'd have to say it without the smile, for if I drew my lips back at all, I'd frighten the wits out of the golden girls under the Biltmore clock. There are days when the girls take off their coats, and the way they look in sweaters and blouses is such an occasion of sin, I have to lock myself in a toilet cubicle and interfere with myself, and I have to be quiet for fear of being discovered by someone, a Puerto Rican bus buyer or Greek waiter, who'll run to the maitre d' and report that their lobby houseman is wanking away in the bathroom. Chapter 5. There's a poster outside the 68th Street Playhouse that says Hamlet with Laurence Olivier coming next week. I'm already planning to treat myself to a night out with a bottle of ginger ale and a lemon meringue pie from the bakery, like the one I had with the priest in Albany, the loveliest taste I ever had in my life. There I'll be watching Hamlet on the screen, tormenting himself and everybody else, and I'll have tartness of ginger ale and sweetness of pie clashing away in my mouth. Before I go to the cinema, I can sit in my room and read Hamlet to make sure I know what they're saying in that old English. The only book I brought from Ireland is The Complete Works of Shakespeare, which I bought in O'Mahony's bookshop for 13 shillings and sixpence, half my wages, when I worked at the post office delivering telegrams. The play I like best is Hamlet, because of what he had to put up with when his mother carried on with her husband's brother Claudius, the way my own mother in Limerick carried on with her cousin Lemon Griffin. I could understand Hamlet raging at his mother the way I did with my mother the night I had my first pint and went home drunk and slapped her face. I'll be sorry for that till the day I die, though I'd still like to go back to Limerick someday and find Lemon Griffin in a pub and tell him step outside, and I'd wipe the floor with him till he begged for mercy. I know it's useless talking like that because Lemon Griffin will surely be dead of the drink and the consumption by the time I return to Limerick, and he'll be a long time in hell before I ever say a prayer or light a candle for him, even if our Lord says we should forgive our enemies and turn the other cheek. No, even if our Lord came back on earth and ordered me to forgive Lemon Griffin on pain of being cast into the sea, with a millstone around my neck, the thing I fear most in the world, I'd have to say, sorry, O Lord, I can never forgive that man for what he did to my mother and my family. Hamlet didn't wander around Elsinore forgiving people in a made-up story, so why should I, in real life? The last time I went to the 68th Street Playhouse, the usher wouldn't let me in with a bar of Hershey chocolate in my hand. He said I couldn't bring in food or drink and I'd have to consume it outside. Consume. He couldn't say eat. And that's one of the things that bothers me in the world, the way ushers and people in uniforms in general always like to use big words. The 68th Street Playhouse isn't a bit like the Lyric Cinema in Limerick, where you could bring in fish and chips or a good feed of pig's feet and a bottle of stout if the humour was on you. The night they wouldn't let me in with the chocolate bar, I had to stand outside and gobble it with the usher glaring at me, and he didn't care that I was missing funny parts of the Marx Brothers. Now I have to carry my black raincoat from Ireland over my arm so that the usher won't spot the bag with the lemon meringue pie or the ginger ale bottle stuck in a pocket. The minute the film starts, I try to go at my pie, but the box crackles and people say, shush, we're trying to watch this film. I know they're not the ordinary type of people who go to gangster films or musicals. These are people who probably graduated from college and live on Park Avenue and know every line of Hamlet. They'll never say they go to movies, only films. I'll never be able to open the box silently, and my mouth is watering with the hunger, and I don't know what to do till the man sitting next to me says hi, slips part of his raincoat over my lap, and lets his hand wander under it. He says, "Am I disturbing you?" And I don't know what to say, though something tells me, "Take my pie and move away." I tell him, "Excuse me," and go by him up the aisle and out to the men's lavatory, where I'm able to open my pie box in comfort without Park Avenue shushing me. I feel sorry over missing part of Hamlet, but all they were doing up there on the screen was jumping around and shouting about a ghost. Even though the men's lavatory is empty, I don't want to be seen opening my box and eating my pie, so I sit on the toilet in the cubicle eating quickly, so that I can get back to Hamlet, as long as I don't have to sit beside the man with the coat in his lap and the wandering hand. The pie makes my mouth dry, and I think I'll have a nice drink of ginger ale till I realize you have to have some class of a church key to lift off the cap. There's no use going to an usher, because they're always barking and telling people they're not supposed to be bringing in food or drink from the outside, even if they're from Park Avenue. I lay the pie box on the floor and decide the only way to knock the cap off the ginger ale bottle is to place it against the sink and give it a good rap with the back of my hand. When I do, the neck of the bottle breaks and the ginger ale gushes up in my face, and there's blood on the sink where I cut my hand on the bottle, and I feel sad with all the things happening to me, that my pie has been drowned on the floor with blood and ginger ale, and wondering at the same time, will I ever be able to see Hamlet with all the troubles I'm having, when a desperate-looking grey-haired man rushes in, nearly knocking me over, and steps on my pie box, destroying it entirely. He stands at the urinal firing away, trying to shake the box off his shoe and barking at me, "Goddamn, goddamn, what the hell, what the hell?" He stands away and swings his leg so that the pie box flies off his shoe and hits the wall, all squashed and beyond eating. The man says, "What the hell is going on here?" And I don't know what to tell him, because it seems like a long story, going all the way back to how excited I was weeks ago about coming to see Hamlet, and how I didn't eat all day because I had a delicious feeling about doing everything at the same time, eating my pie, drinking ginger ale, seeing Hamlet, and hearing all the glorious speeches. I don't think the man is in the mood from the way he dances from one foot to the other, telling me the toilet is not a goddamn restaurant, that I have no goddamn business hanging around public bathrooms eating and drinking, and I'd better get my ass out of there. I tell him I had an accident trying to open the ginger ale bottle, and he says, "Didn't you ever hear of an opener? Are you just off the goddamn boat?" He leaves the lavatory, and just as I'm wrapping the toilet paper around my cut, the usher comes in and says, "There's a customer complaint about my behavior in here." He's like the grey-haired man with his goddamn and what the hell. When I try to explain what happened, he says, "Get your ass out of here." I tell him I paid to see Hamlet, and I came in here so that I wouldn't be disturbing all the Park Avenue people around me who know Hamlet backwards and forwards, but he says, "I don't give a shit. Get out before I call the manager or the cops, who will surely be interested in the blood all over the place." Then he points to my black raincoat draped in the sink. "Take that goddamn raincoat out of here. What are you doing with a raincoat on a day there ain't a cloud in the sky? We know the raincoat trick, and we're watching. We know the whole raincoat brigade. We're onto your little queer games. You sit there looking innocent, and the next thing the hand is wandering over to innocent kids. So, get your raincoat out of here, buddy, before I call the cops, you goddamn pervert." I take the broken ginger ale bottle with a drop left and walk down 68th Street and sit on the steps of my rooming house, till Mrs. Austin calls through the basement window there's to be no eating or drinking on the steps. Cockroaches will come running from all over, and people will say we're a bunch of Puerto Ricans who don't care where they eat or drink or sleep. There's no place to sit anywhere along the street with landladies peering and watching. There's nothing to do but wander over to a park by the East River and wonder why America is so hard and complicated that I have trouble going to see Hamlet with a lemon meringue pie and a bottle of ginger ale. Chapter 6. The worst part of getting up and going to work in New York is the way my eyes are so infected, I have to pull the lids apart with thumb and forefinger. I'm tempted to pick at the hard yellow crust, but if I do, the eyelashes will come away with it and leave my eyelids red and sore, worse than they were before. I can stand in the shower and let hot water run in my eyes till they feel warm and clean, even if they're still blazing right in my head. I try to freeze the red away with icy cold water, but it never works. It just makes my eyeballs ache, and things are bad enough without me going to the Biltmore lobby with an ache in the eyeball. I could put up with aching eyeballs if I didn't have the soreness and the redness and the yellow ooze. At least people wouldn't be staring at me as if I was some class of a leper. It's shameful enough going around the Palm Court in the black houseman's uniform, which means I'm just above the Puerto Rican dishwashers in the eyes of the world. Even the porters have a touch of gold in their uniforms, and the doormen themselves look like admirals of the fleet. Eddie Gilligan, the union shop steward, says it's a good thing I'm Irish, or it's down in the kitchen I'd be with the spics. That's a new word, spics. And I know from the way he says it that he doesn't like Puerto Ricans. He tells me Mr. Carey takes good care of his own people. That's why I'm a houseman with a uniform instead of an apron down there with the PR singing, yelling, "Mirror, mirror," all day. I'd like to ask him what's wrong with singing when you're washing dishes and yelling, "Mirror, mirror," when the humor is on you. But I'm wary of asking questions for fear of being foolish. At least the Puerto Ricans are together down there singing and banging away on pots and pans till they're carried away with their own music and dance around the kitchen till the bosses tell them, "Cut it out." Sometimes I go down to the kitchen, and they give me bits of leftover food and call me, "Frankie, Frankie, Irish boy, we teach you Spanish." Eddie Gilligan says I'm paid $2.50 a week more than the dishwashers, and I have opportunities for advancement they'll never have, because all they want to do is not learn English and make enough money to go back to Puerto Rico and sit under trees drinking beer and having big families, because that's all they're good for, drinking and screwing till their wives are worn out and die before their time, and their kids run the streets, ready to come to New York and wash dishes and start the whole goddamn thing over again. And if they can't get jobs, we have to support them, you and me, so they can sit on their stoops up in East Harlem, playing the goddamn guitars and drinking beer out of paper bags. That's the spics, kid, and don't you forget it. Stay away from that kitchen, because they wouldn't think twice about pissing in your coffee. He says he saw them pissing in the coffee urn that was being sent to a big lunch for the daughters of the British Empire, and the daughters never guessed for one second that they were drinking Puerto Rican piss. Then Eddie smiles and laughs and chokes on his cigarette, because he's Irish-American, and he thinks the PRs are great for what they did to the daughters of the British Empire. He calls them PRs now instead of spics, because they did something patriotic the Irish should have thought of in the first place. Next year, he'll piss in the coffee urns himself and laugh himself to death watching the daughters drink coffee that's Puerto Rican and Irish piss. He says it's a great pity the daughters will never know. He'd like to get up there on the balcony of the 19th-floor ballroom and make a general announcement. "Daughters of the British Empire, you have just drank coffee filled with spick mick piss, and how does that feel after what you did to the Irish for 700 years? Oh, that'd be a sight, all the daughters clutching each other and throwing up all over the ballroom, and Irish patriots dancing jigs in their graves. That'd be something," says Eddie. "That'd be really something." Now Eddie says maybe the PRs aren't that bad at all. He wouldn't want them marrying his daughter, moving into his neighborhood. But you have to admit they're musical, and they send up pretty good baseball players, you have to admit that. You go down to that kitchen, and they're always happy like kids. He says they're like the Negroes. They don't take nothing serious, not like the Irish. We take everything serious. The bad days in the lobby are Thursday and Friday, when the boys and girls meet and sit and drink and laugh. Nothing on their minds but college and romance, sailing around in the summer, skiing in the winter, and marrying each other so that they'll have children who will come to the Biltmore and do the same. I know they don't even see me in my houseman's uniform with my dustpan and broom, and I'm glad, because there are days my eyes are so red they look bloody, and I dread it when a girl might say, "Excuse me, where is the restroom?" It's hard to point with your dustpan and say, over there beyond the elevators, and keep your face turned away at the same time. I tried that with one girl, but she went to the maitre d' and complained I was rude. And now I have to look at everyone who asks a question, and when they stare at me I blush so hard, I'm sure my skin matches my eyes in the redness department. Sometimes I blush out of pure anger, and I want to snarl at the people who stare at me, but if I did, I'd be fired on the spot. They shouldn't stare. They should know better the way their mothers and fathers are spending fortunes to make them educated. And what's the use of all that education if you're so ignorant you stare at people just off the boat with red eyes? You'd think the professors would be standing in front of their classes telling them that if you go to the Biltmore Hotel lobby or any lobby, you're not to be staring at people with red eyes or one leg or any class of a disfigurement. The girls stare anyway, and the boys are worse, the way they look at me and smile and nudge and pass remarks that make everyone laugh. And I'd like to break my dustpan and broom over their heads till blood spurted and they beg me to stop and promise they'll never again pass remarks on anyone's sore eyes. One day there's a yelp from a college girl, and the maitre d' rushes over. She's crying, and he's moving things around on the table before her, and looking under it, shaking his head. He calls across the lobby, "McCourt, get over here right now. Did you clean up around this table?" "I think I did." "You think you did? God damn it. Excuse me, miss, don't you know?" "I did, sir." "Did you remove a paper napkin?" "I cleaned up. I emptied the ashtrays." "Paper napkin that was here, did you take it?" "I don't know." "Well, let me tell you something, McCourt. This young lady here is the daughter of the president of the traffic club that rents a huge space in this hotel, and she had a paper napkin with the phone number from a Princeton boy, and if you don't find that piece of paper, your ass is in hot water. Excuse me, miss. Now, what did you do with the trash you took away?" "It's gone down to the big garbage bins near the kitchen." "All right, go down there and search for that paper napkin. And don't come back without it." The girl who lost the napkin sobs and tells me her father has a lot of influence here and she wouldn't want to be me if I don't find that piece of paper. Her friends are looking at me and I feel my face is on fire with my eyes. The maitre d' snaps at me again. "Go get it, McCourt, and report back here." The garbage bins by the kitchen are overflowing, and I don't know how I'm going to find a small piece of paper lost in all that waste. Coffee grounds, bits of toast, fish bones, eggshells, grapefruit skins. I'm on my knees, poking and separating with a fork from the kitchen, where the Puerto Ricans are singing and laughing and banging on pots and pans, and that makes me wonder what I'm doing on my knees. So I get up and go into the kitchen, saying nothing to the Puerto Ricans calling to me, "Frankie, Frankie, Irish boy, we teach you Spanish." I find a clean paper napkin, write a made-up phone number on it, stain it with coffee, hand it to the maitre d', who hands it to the girl with her friends, cheering on all sides. She thanks the maitre d' and passes him a tip, a whole dollar, and my only sorrow is that I won't be there when she calls that number.